Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dateline NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We do appreciate your amazing and continued support. And since we're talking about Iconic, they wanted me to let you know that if you're interested in trying out their program, which is basically Netflix for the alternative media, there is a link in the show notes that'll get you 10 days for free. You can try it before you buy it. Obviously, there's all of David Icke's work there that's worth the price of admission just in and of itself. But they're also doing weekly shows. They're doing their own original content, original movies, original series. There's a lot going on there, especially if you're into health and wellness. A little bit of a surprising component that you might not think would be associated with the Iconic or the Ike name, but you got to go in there and check it out. They're doing fantastic things. And like I said, you can try before you buy. Thank you to our amazing sponsors. C60 Purple Power has been with us for over a year now. Since they sent me the first bottle of their magic potion, I've been taking a spoonful every single day. No joke. Every day I get a spoon and every day my cat gets a spoonful. So it's a win-win. This, if you are unfamiliar with the carbon-60 molecule, the group of scientists that discovered C60 wound up winning the Nobel Prize for it. It's that important. It is a naturally occurring carbon molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms that forms something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. They call it a free radical sponge that travels through your body, able to neutralize free radicals and reset itself again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known to man. It is several hundred times more powerful than anything that's out there right now. Ken, the scientist, is the CEO. He's been on this show before. I've done a bunch of shows with him. We've talked about some crazy things. It's a really good thing that he's in charge of making this because he explained to me the process by how they which they make C60 Purple Power, and it sounded really confusing. So I'll tell you what. All I ask is that you read up on it and see for yourself. You can go to shopc60.com. Read everything there is to know about it. And if you're interested, use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself a little bit of extra money. And also, good Lord, since we're living through a supply chain nightmare in real time, I think it's time for everybody to get prepared. I've been pretty consistent about this. I don't care if you use my sponsor, My Patriot Supply, or if you do it on your own. I just want to know that you're all taken care of. I want to know that you're being proactive. You're thinking about these things. If you are so inclined, you can go to the web landing page that they built for us, preparewithmacroaggressions.com. And from there, you can find a 4-week supply of food. You can find 3-month supply of food. They have seeds. They have emergency coffee, which I still don't know what that is, but it's Sounds like I figured coffee was always an emergency, but what do I know? If you're interested, they have air purifiers, water filters, all kinds of camping gear, just about anything that you would need to survive the coming zombie apocalypse. Hopefully it's not going to happen this year, but look, there are forces at work that are very powerful. They are setting the stage for us to have catastrophe after catastrophe. You do not want to be reactive. You would like to be proactive. There's downtime. Right now, as you're listening to this, there's still time to do something about this. There may come a time when there's not. So if you are so inclined, you can go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and save yourself a little bit of money that way. But either way, buy some extra food at the grocery store, start a little stash spot, get your money out of the bank, start thinking about this stuff from a different angle. You'll be grateful that you did. Well, if you've watched my show here, Macroaggressions, you probably have watched The Union of the Unwanted as well. And my partner, Ricky Verandis over there, he is the guest master. He is in charge of, he's the party planner. He's in charge of reaching out to everybody. And one of his favorite people in the world that he invited on one time early on is our guest, Richard Grove. After the first interview on Union of the Unwanted, I understood quite clearly why Ricky was such a fan. Richard Grove is the founder of Grand Theft World. Are you watching that these days? That's something you definitely need to get into. You can find that on Rockfin and a lot of other places. And also, he is the founder of the University of Reason, Richard Grove, everybody. How are you, Richard?
How you doing, Charlie?
I'm good.
Thanks for having me. And I'm thinking about that storable food situation and the emergency coffee.
Yeah. It lasts 25 years.
I didn't get it at first. I got the food first, but after I had so much food, I was like, yeah, I need coffee and I need freeze-dried bacon. Now they had good coffee. I still haven't found like the freeze-dried bacon place. So if you get an affiliate link for that place, you let me know.
But likewise, and, likewise. I'll be one.
Yeah, seriously. I've had a couple students try it. Like they have like they bought commercial grade freeze dryers, but it's like a process to figure out what the right outcome, what kind of right input to get the right output, you know.
I'll give some bacon over to Ken Schwartz, the science guy over at C60. He's a nuclear physicist. He'll figure it out. He'll figure out how to freeze dry bacon. If he's able to communicate with Bigfoot, he's able to freeze dry some bacon, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out because I've heard people talk about the Buckyball, Buckminster Fullerene kind of carbon and how it's more than just like an activated charcoal. Carbon, like because people, you know, take activated charcoal for various reasons. So, I'm going to do the research. I'm going to read up on that for myself.
Ken's a cool guy. He lives not too far from me out here in Denver. That's where their company is based. So he explained to me the whole process by which they make. I mean, I nodded my head like I understood. He explained it like in painful detail, the chemical process that it goes through. And I mean, it was so confusing to me. The fact that these guys are able to figure anything out is amazing. So
I think the role of antioxidants these days is more important than maybe it was even a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's something, you know, whether it's guests that come on or it's sponsors or whatever, I feel like if we can just, I don't know it all, obviously. I feel like there's other people that have pieces to this puzzle. Let's have them come on. Or if you're a small company and you're building really cool products that are super helpful, let's talk, let's have them on. Let's talk about this. If you're someone that's telling everybody, if you're a company that's telling everyone, let's be proactive. I love that, as opposed to people that are, trying to get you scared and then make you reactive to it. So I'm in favor of collecting as many people that are on the right side of this as possible.
Yeah. I mean, Freedom has had a marketing and sales problem. In other words, like how do we make ourselves self-driving in the absence of having big billionaire funders like the left has?
Yeah.
Right. Or even some of the right has big billionaire funders. But the people who are trying to do like the truth work, I read this quote the other day on an interview, but there's a quote by Plato from the Republic. And basically, it's like he is their worst enemy who tells them the truth. So while what we do is very necessary to a healthy society, it's not really rewarded. And when it's become corporatized and rewarded, it turned out to no longer be news and it turns into propaganda for those special interests that are rewarding that system. So it's a balancing game. And so by picking up some sponsors that believe in freedom and have quality products, I think that's the way forward.
Well, I think it is too. And you would know something about paying the price for telling the truth, right? I mean, you got started. I'm interested to know your story as it relates to financial fraud and whistleblowing and the scenario that you were involved in that I would assume led you down this, changed your whole life course and led you down this path. What can you tell us about how you got started in this whole industry?
All right. So I'll give you the short briefer, kind of fits in an hour. Otherwise it turns into, like when I got asked this the other day with Addy Ads and Peter Duke, I said, look, here's some homework. Like you can go listen to Project Constellation and you get this piece, and then you can listen to 2020 Hindsight and get this other piece. And that's going to take a couple hours, and to shorten it down means I have to cut out certain parts. And then, you know, shit happens when you do that. So I want to just give, like I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. I went to public school. I went to college for 5 years, and, cause I switched majors, you know how they get you.
Yeah.
And during college, I was like working, my traditional job was a fry cook. Like I worked in kitchens for like 5 or 6 years. But I also did a stint at a video store. So I was like doing like small time jobs to try to pay for college, try to pay for rent, try to pay for food. And I saw this ad in the newspaper, and I always explain it to the students. Like I wasn't reading the newspaper in college, the college newspaper. I wasn't like looking at the articles. I was looking for bar ads. Like where's quarter pitchers tonight here, you know?
Yeah.
And I saw this ad and it said, make $10,000 this summer. And I thought I only make like $3,500 over a summer, like working really hard. What do I have to do to this to get that? Like, how do I have to level up? What do I have to do? And it was a franchise opportunity where they taught us how to run a business, how to do sales, hiring and firing, how to get, you know, knock on doors, these sort of things, how to deliver excellence, how to like, cause we did it no money down until they were satisfied. We did like light home renovations, painting, refinishing decks, cleaning sidewalks, any of that type of stuff. So running that business through college gave me practical entrepreneurial experience, but I didn't have a vision for it yet. So when it came to, I get a graduation, you know, degree, what am I going to do in the world with this degree? Do I go to job fairs like my friends and wait in line to get a shitty offer? Mm-hmm. And I had access to a buddy of mine who was a year older than me, but we played hockey together in high school. And he was working at a software company. I'm like, what are you doing out there? He was working in Princeton, New Jersey. And he's like, I'm in sales. I'm like, dude, I've been running the company for the past 3 years. I'm the only one that knows about how sales. Like, how are you working? He's like, oh, well, you just kind of learn. There's no degree for it. So I got that job, got my foot in the door, and I excelled because I was taught sales as a service, as a problem solving. So you're not pushing, persuading, convincing, or conniving people. You're dealing with people who have a problem, and they're actually looking for a solution. So the first place I went to work for was a database modeling company. It was like the fastest growing small business in America. And it was like a thrilling environment. And I got recruited out of there into another company. Because when you excel at sales and you can blow out your quotas, it makes ripples and people come find you. Recruiters come find you. But mostly it was like people from other companies that came and got me. So I went up through a couple jobs, moving various places. I moved from like Princeton to DC, Virginia area, and then to New York City. So by the time I'm out of school, I don't know, three years probably. Because I graduated in 97. By 99, I'm living in New York City. And I'm good at what I do. And I'm working for a company called Sterling Software, which was like Texas Instruments, the Wiley brothers from Texas, billionaires. Mm-hmm. And they were getting bought out by Computer Associates. So everybody was looking for a job. And my boss at Sterling went and interviewed down the street. You know, we were like, I think we were in the Helmsley building at that point, that's like straddles Park Avenue. So down on Madison was where Silverstream was. I know it's like Silver and Sterling, but software companies. Anyway, my boss went to get a job there. He says, you should interview at this place. So we both got hired in as equals. So he's no longer my boss. He's like my teammate, right? Mm-hmm. And I excelled in that situation. It was a 300 person company, Silverstream was. They had just gone public and they're looking for larger clients because we were selling web servers, which is like, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 a pop. I was able to identify a client that had a huge project and it would be like a multi-million dollar deal. And so for Silverstream, that was a big deal, biggest deal they had ever had in software or services. So the client's name was Marsh and McLennan Companies, and they're a conglomerate. They own like Guy Carpenter and a bunch of other little companies. And they did reinsurance, like insurance on insurance. They're the world's largest reinsurance brokerage. I got no idea about any of this stuff, right?
I only found out about it because of Warren Buffett investing in General Re. And I was like, that's a dumb name for a company. It's like, well, it's a reinsurance company. I was like, what? I was like,
General Re took a big fall on 9/11 too. They're part of the insurance with the Silverstein thing.
Yeah.
So I'm working at Marsh. They wanted to do this thing called Marsh.com, and it's taking all their legacy data and webifying it, right? Taking all this Lotus Notes, kind of COBOL, ancient, you know, mainframe type stuff, bring it to the web. All right. So we have a team of people from my side, like 20, 30 developers and contractors that are there working on the Marsh project. And we get to, so this is like, it's kicked off October 2000. So by January 2001, that process is going, it's thriving. I'm getting big commission checks as they're paying big bills. I'm getting big commission checks. And by June, we were delivering Marsh.com probably by July. So they were looking to do phase two. And phase two was going to be not a 1 million in software. It's going to be 5 million in software and another 5 million in services, like $10 million deal. So June 4th, I got verbal confirmation from the CIO, this guy, Gary. And he said, you guys got the deal. We're going to go forward. So I let my bosses know. But also at that point, because I had like that nice hand at the poker round, I wanted to ask the question also. Hey, you guys have been billing Marsh and McLennan for millions of dollars that me and my sales team haven't been getting paid on. And I don't know what all this stuff is that you guys are doing. And I attached like, I don't know, 6 pages of timesheets to be like, here's all these people. And I copied my team, letting them know like, hey guys, we got more commission coming. I don't know what this is, but we should be getting paid. I thought nothing of it because I just closed this mega deal and my commission on this new deal. So that's June 4th. My perspective on June 4th is I'm getting 20% of a $5 million deal. It's $1 million commission check. And I'm probably not going to do sales and software anymore. I'm probably going to like check out, retire and go chill. I go to work on Tuesday, June 5th, and they fire me. Like, it's a long story, but my boss gets me to go in his office. His boss had flown in unbeknownst to me. He hid behind the door, closed the door behind me to make it dramatic. Like this theatrical stuff they did. So I didn't think a whole lot of it. I just thought these creeps want to take my commission. And then the deal didn't pan out like my former bosses had planned. Because if you remove the relationship part of that whole thing, it doesn't have to go if it doesn't want to.
Right.
And then by September 11th, I had been through an emergency surgery. My former employer came and bribed me, got me to sign a new contract, confidentiality, plus they would pay me $9,999. This is like April 24th, 2001. August, right? Okay. So a couple of weeks before 9/11. So I'd had this surgery. They come to me a couple of days later while I was still like getting the pain stuff out of my body. Whatever they had me on after emergency, they removed my gallbladder, right? So I was on painkillers. So they're like, hey, your insurance, your Cobra is going to run out. Your Cobra kind of carryover insurance after they terminate somebody, right?
Yeah.
But they also gave me the check, the extended insurance, and reference letters from the chief financial officer of the company, a glowing reference letter. Right. Rich is like a model, you know, employee. People love working with him. Clients love working with him. I've personally gone on trips with him and had fantastic client experiences. Okay. That seemed okay when I was like on the pain meds. But a couple of days later, I'm like, dude, what is going on with this? That's a bribe. Why $9,999? Because if it's one more dollar, they have to tell the board of directors. They're giving Grove money and having them do this stuff. But $1 below that, they can keep it below the radar. Mm. So August 27-ish, or it's like the end of August, beginning of September. I had a buddy I'd worked with. at two different jobs. And he had a new job, and he was the New York City account manager for a company on the West Coast called Alto Web. And he's like, hey, let's go to dinner. My boss is coming in town. We should all hang out. And I was like, well, what's up? He's like, well, you don't have a job, and they don't have a New York account manager, and I live in Boston, and maybe, you know, you want to get a job here. So I took him to dinner at Windows on the World, because I still, like, that's where I had taken clients to Impressive Place. The guy that was my buddy's boss had to borrow a jacket from the maitre d' to be able to sit in there. I was a little embarrassed about, like, not like, hey, dude, you have to have a jacket.
Right.
We have some martinis. We have good discussion. I get a job offer. So I was feeling a little like maybe I should let the people know who are working at my former client that there's this stuff going on, that they've come to me and bribed me. Mm-hmm. That I'm reasonably sure all these people are going to get fired without no, like, because they were told they were going to have continuity once it all went web. They would find new positions for these people.
Right.
But from behind the scenes, the whole second part of the project that they were, like, partially carrying on, but not with us, was going to get rid of all these people's jobs. There was no intended transition for the Lotus Notes database operators and these sort of things.
Gotcha.
So I made a call. I left a message for a secretary, Norma Taddy. I got a message back on Monday and to, like, drop the documents off that I'd had since June, which is all these timesheets with the emails and my questioning of it and the totals. Well, I'm on my way there Tuesday, September 11th. And my plan is to go across the river after dropping off these documents. And I got a buddy he had rented out a beach house, and this was the last week that they're having it. We were supposed to have, like, a casual rest of the week chilling. I think it was in Red Bank. I'd never been there, but I'd been to many other places in Jersey, and this dude was pretty cool. And I never got there that day. So
right.
I'm not dressed to go to a business meeting. I'm, like, in shorts and, like, my t-shirt to go to the beach, but I'm dropping off a folder to just, like, you know, leave in this meeting that I was told that they were having a global conference call with all the people involved, and that there was going to be a break. And if I just drop these documents off, these people would figure out and confront the people. Right. So I had no plans on being in there very long, but my apartment was on 87th and Riverside. So my whole drive to the World Trade Centers is they're almost in sight the whole time. Like, you're driving down West Side Highway, there are some of the tallest buildings in the world. They're pretty much in sight the whole time. Yeah. I'm in a Porsche 911 convertible with the top down. I got a CD playing. I'm driving down West Side Highway. I get below Canal Street. And then those buildings get really big when you get closer to them, right? So they're not really in your line of vision. I'm at a red light. Red light goes off. And, like, you know, no one's moving. So I'm like, okay. And so it's not unusual in New York for a red light to turn and the cars don't move and you have to sit there for another red light. But during that time, it was like this, something going on in the cab next to me, to my left, caught my attention. I turned down my whatever I was playing, some CD, and I heard news on the radio. Something's going on. So I turn on my radio. I haven't looked up yet. Turn on my radio. 1010 Winds is the AM station to get news. And it tells me that the World Trade Center is on fire, and that it was hit either by a Cessna or, like, a helicopter. So I look up at that point, and the place where I'm about to go to, World Trade Center 1, 96th floor, right? Because 96 through 98 is where Marshall McLennan was primarily. They had other floors right there, but primarily that's where we worked. And so I'm just like, okay, so the building's on fire. They got sprinkler systems. There's been an accident. And it didn't not make sense to me, because looking down from the offices there, you could see Cessnas and helicopters in kind of close proximity,
right,
flying down the Hudson. So I'm thinking, okay, tragic accident. There's no firefighters or anyone here yet. I don't want to go down further into Battery Park. I'm definitely not going into this building now. So I made a left. And I get onto Vesey Street, and now there's traffic, but it's kind of crawling forward, but everyone's kind of, you know, rubbernecking. And someone asked me the other day, like, did you put the top up? I'm like, no, I didn't put the top up. And there is stuff coming down, but nothing was, like, falling on me, right? So I wasn't like, danger, danger, Will Robinson, yet. So that that whole thing, it goes on for like, I don't know, 18 minutes. It went on for several minutes before I even saw that the building was on fire, right? So I don't know at what point some airline, commercial airliner flew over my head at 500 miles an hour at 1,000 feet and hit the building. I'm somewhere on West Side Highway right there when that supposedly happens, according to the Naudé Brothers film. Okay. At the point where Trade Center 2 then explodes, I don't see anything because it's like whatever happened, if something external came in and hit it, was outside my view. But what set me off was when Trade Center 2 explodes, I'm right between Trade Center 6, Trade Center 7 over here. And as 2 explodes, and I look from here over to here, my peripheral vision catches like these flashes going off in the building next to me. And already my brain was like, when the second tower blew up and this tower was already on fire, it told me that like, this isn't accidental. And then when the other thing started happening next to me, I was like, danger, danger, Will Robinson, like get the fuck out of, you know, Dodge here.
Yeah.
And I panicked and I had never thought that I could, like, it was just so far out of my expected perspective for even New York City. Like they hadn't had like, you know, terrorist attack there, anything like that since like 93 World Trade Center bombing. Right. Yeah. And this seemed to be at that time, a grander scale of event. And I headed straight toward the Hudson Tunnel is the closest one. Holland Tunnel. And as I make a left to go in the Holland Tunnel, there's a dude in military gear with like one of the wooden things you block off the street with, barricade.
Yeah.
And he's like barricading off the area I'm trying. So I get through that tunnel. And I was like, what the fuck is that? Why are there military guys? How did it military? I don't know what's going on.
Right.
So then I get outside of the tunnel. I make a left. I'm heading down through New Jersey. And I'm like, I'm going fast because I'm headed now to my buddy's house in Princeton from the beginning of the story. He still lived and worked down there. Mm-hmm. And he was going to be at the beach house later. I just figured I'd go to his house now because shit's happening. And on the way there, then it's like the Pentagon's been hit. And it was at that point when I just floored it. And I did stop before to do that. I did put the top up for that because if you're going to drive that car top speed, you don't want it the top down. And I figured I had like every excuse in the world to drive fast that day because
like
the world's ending. I don't know what's going on, but I want to get to some people I know and figure it out.
Yeah.
So from there, like there's the trauma of the event. There's the funerals because there was a lot of people I knew and worked with, and you're going to their funerals and wakes and these sort of things. And by November, I started noticing more than I had seen that day, right? Evidence of insider trading on Marsh & McLennan and American mm-hmm. Airlines and a couple of the other companies involved. And then when you eventually trace those back, they go to clients of mine, Deutsche Bank, and they go to, you know, people that were former executive directors of the CIA. Buzzy Krongard was one of those guys. And then there was the Kroll Associates angle where I had a client, AIG. I had a client, Marsh & McLennan. AIG was Hank Greenberg, former mm-hmm. nominee to direct the CIA. AIG was at that time, still is, public front for intelligence agencies. AIG at that time had the world's largest private air force.
Whoa.
Hank Greenberg's son, Jeff, CEO of Marsh & McLennan Insurance. Hank Greenberg's son, Alex, over here. He has like three sons. They were all in charge of insurance companies. So now you got four insurance companies involved in 9/11 inside one family, all adversely affected from this thing. And Kroll Associates was wholly owned by Marsh and AIG. Now, who is Kroll Associates? Never heard of Kroll Associates. Well, first off, the comedian Nick Kroll, his dad, Jules Kroll, had a private intelligence agency and private protection, executive protection. Like they would do armored cars for, you know, dignitaries and presidents and heads of state. And Kroll has worked in South Africa with the apartheid regimes to help suppress. And so international, private, security company that took over World Trade Center security right before 9/11, who employed John O'Neill, who formerly worked as the head of counterterrorism, specializing in Osama bin Laden. O'Neill gets fired in August 2001. He's the top Osama bin Laden expert. He then gets hired to work in Kroll Associates, dies on 9/11. Yeah. Tragically, after only like working there for 2 weeks, the two people who are credited with finding his body and identifying that he died is Bernard Carrick, Jerome Hauer. Hauer works for Kroll. He's the one that told the White House to go on Cipro a week before the anthrax attacks, right? Whoa. So there was just a whole bunch of like, there's a can of worms there. You open it, you're going to see past box cutters and Arab terrorists working on their own really fast. So it was a long, long understand. Like, I first thought the lesson is, if you're going to be in executive sales and you're going to work helping these companies, you should figure out what these companies are all about. There wasn't an easy resource, right? Like David Icke was still pretty unheard of back then, right? So yeah. I had every excuse to be naive, to be ignorant, to be nescient, any of those things. But yeah. Those excuses don't hold up in the battlefield of reality. I found myself in the middle of geopolitical machinations for which I had no, it's not on my map. I got to get out of here. And so that experience drove me into, okay, I was just like, I was at the top of my game pretty much. Like, I learned a skill set in college. I put that skill set to work. I earned $1 million before I was 30. I was about to make another $1 million on top of that before I was 30 when that situation started to like, I'd never been fired before, man. That was so out of left field.
Yeah.
Then a couple months later, 9/11 happens, right?
Where they're luring you into the kill zone.
The dude who was responsible did not go to that meeting. The other woman who is a global CIO, she attended it virtually, and it seemed like expendable people were the ones in the building.
And L. Paul Bremer was conveniently sitting in the lobby of NBC News so that he could deliver his assessment of who this boogeyman might have been. And then
he says bin Laden.
A year and a half, he's in charge of the, or a couple years, he's in charge of the Iraq rebuilding process when he has, by all accounts, he's completely and totally unqualified for that job. But he'd been a good little boy and did what he was told, and he was being rewarded.
All right, so there's two aspects here. First off, who tells America first it's Osama bin Laden? Is it L. Paul Bremer or is it Andrea Mitchell, whose husband is this guy, little known guy named... Alan Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan's
wife says it's Osama bin Laden, or this guy L. Paul Bremer says it's Osama bin Laden, also around like 9:30 a.m. Eastern time.
And also,
L. Paul Bremer was
in the BBC is saying the same thing too.
They might be getting their script from the same group of people. But L. Paul Bremer was in charge of global risk mitigation for Marsh and McLennan, which is a real, like, that's like the risk and crisis management. And the guy's like not there when the risk and crisis management had to happen. He also works for Kissinger Associates. So if you know anything about Dope Inc. and Kissinger Associates and what the East India Company's skullduggery got into in the 20th century, like, he works for that front. That's how he got to be governor of Iraq, when truckloads of U.S. $100 bill pallets just go missing and no one says anything. So yeah, there's like the inside jobbiness of it. And then you get into like, did they let it happen on purpose or did they make it happen on purpose? And it's not even just inside job, because it's really United States, Israel, and the UK. And you can't really draw lines between their intelligence and their operate. It's like, it was a joint operation to achieve very specific purposes, one of which is to bring in this TSA Patriot Act mentality to corrode the individuality of Americans and to make them like, stop and papers, please, and get your vaccine passport soon. Right. That all comes back from like, they had the foot and mouth disease in Britain, where you had to like walk through the pans of chemicals and all that sort of stuff. And before that, they had to like, so they mixed that policy with the Israeli keep your airline secure from terrorist policy. And they brought those two things to America, which are very un-American things, but in the guise of 9/11 hijackers and this whole sort of thing. But, you know, so I looked into the corporate aspects because those were the first pieces of entanglement that I identified. And then I started looking into the financial aspect, the paramilitary aspects, the NATO aspect. There's a whole bunch of stuff. You just even looking and asking the questions, who are these hijackers? Because the way I play the game of 9/11, explain the game is we've got a clear desk. What piece of evidence from that day would you like to put on, Charlie?
I would say that I'd like to know why Building 7 came down in a controlled demolition.
Okay. That's an easy spot, right? We could watch any number of Richard Gage and Leon Halsey presentations to show you that they must have made it come down on its own.
Right.
It wasn't guys with box cutters, right? But if someone said, okay, World Trade Center 2 fell down. All right. So why did that fall down? Well, it fell down because flight 195 flew into it. All right. So what's the way we could identify flight 195? There's transponders, there's black box, there's serial numbers on all the parts, there's all these things. And when you start with the individual parts, either the planes, or the hijackers, or especially when you try to mix those two things together, there's a whole bunch of questions that can't be answered. Like when the planes cross over Stewart Air Force Base, disappear from radar and transponders, and then turn back on, I might think that the planes could have been switched. Has anyone checked on that? Oh, what do they do out of Stewart Air Force Base? They bring in a lot of drugs from Germany under the guy, like they've been caught, right? And who was in charge of that base? The guys that were running the Port Authority, and they had just changed over ownership a couple months earlier to have specific regulation. It's like, it's just dirty from the get-go of asking two questions into it. But most people don't. They assume, oh, well, the story is true, and they don't really dig into it, and they don't get to see that these guys who were the alleged hijackers are more likely being trained for Saudi princes to run drugs.
Well, the way that you, like, this is a prime example. The way you break down 9/11, just break it down into these smaller pieces that people can digest or get people to ask the question. It's a new way. It's a different way of educating people. It's to get engaging them and getting them to think about this, something that we really weren't taught in school all that much. And you come out of traditional schools like I did. You got to get a job in the real world. You know, you just have to, and you do all that stuff. And then you get into a line of where you're making good money and you're working in a corporation. Then you see the dark underbelly of this and how disgusting it can be. But the thought process that you have towards breaking down 9/11 and questioning aspects of it actually works really well to make to sort of in the way of teaching other people not what to think but how to think.
Yeah.
And I'm not even a bit surprised that you had links to John Taylor Gatto, because I quoted him in my first book, The Octopus of Global Control, when we got on the education side of things. And I was unfamiliar with him until I was writing that book. And I found myself in a rabbit hole where I watched hour after hour after hour of the lectures I could find of him talking. I would listen to it because he came at this education system from what appeared to be a totally different way. And I really connected with it. I thought he was genius. And now where we go from you working at Marsh & McLennan, identifying this, what can best be described as, you know, corporate espionage and terrorism, government sanctioned terrorism that's involved in this. Now you find yourself in a system where you're teaching people how to critically think. Like, what a fascinating journey from being the student to becoming, so to speak, the master, where you're teaching people how to do that. How'd you get associated with John Taylor Gatto, and how'd you wind up eventually getting into doing what you're doing with University of Reason?
Well, it's a long story. So I worked two more years after 9/11 in the corporate world. I ended up working as a director of sales for an artificial intelligence company. I was like a 30 person small startup. And then I worked at last company, which started out as like a 3,000 person company that merged with like a 30,000 person company, right? And that's where I became a federal whistleblower. Because I knew enough at that point, like I was paying attention. And then when I was being asked to do illegal things, I started documenting that. And then as I started bringing up, hey, this is, we shouldn't be doing this, I experienced retaliation. And then I went through a whistleblower process at the federal level. I did that for 3 years. And then I represented myself pro se in court. And when I found out from that, like if you can put all the record on the record of them admitting that they're doing the thing and they can still get away with it, like there's no justice there. And so I didn't appeal after, you know, I think it was like, I said the other day, it was 6 months, but it was 9 months after trial that we got the decision that, oh, by the way, even though what you said in trial is true and they didn't fight it because they didn't have any evidence against it, we can't find in your favor for various reasons, including like being outside statute of limitations. Like you could have figured that out 3 years ago. You didn't right. have to get hundreds of hours of them admitting it on the record, you know? Right, right. So I kind of just set that aside and chalked it up to lesson learned, right? I thought whistleblowers had protections. I thought it was illegal to retaliate. I proved that they retaliated against me. Nothing happens, man. It's like whistleblowing is like early warning for them to cover it up and get rid of you. Right. That's what the whole system that they've designed. So from there, I got heavy in the research because I didn't want to go back out onto the board and make another move without knowing like who's in control of this thing, what's really going on here. Because most people never get beyond that kind of glass ceiling of, you know, this is how the world works. There's checks and balances. And if you just read New York Times and Wall Street Journal and The Economist, you're going to be a well-educated, you know, upward mobile person. There came a point where it's like, I don't want to contribute the brain power between my ears to any of their endeavors. And so I would rather read a book every day, all day on in figuring out what's going on than contribute more tax dollars and give these people anything right now. So like that process went on for a couple years and I got to the point where I was trying to, I had the common syndrome of expecting somebody else to do the thing I was supposed to do. So I was really getting good by this point of saying, look, there are these corporate connections, the 9/11, and it really goes someplace. So I was trying to get somebody else to do something with it.
Right.
Man, I must have sent 50 of these packages to InfoWars over the years. Like if Alex would just talk about it on the show and then other people could dig in and research, that's like the thing.
Right.
And after a certain period of time, I wasn't having success because it was like a little too complicated for most of the people I was sending it to. Mm-hmm. And then I heard an interview and with Maria Heller and I sent it to her and then she listened and she's like, this has to go out and be published. I'm like, I didn't write that to be published. I wrote that so you could do the research and like do something about it. She's like, well, you know, I think it should be, the world should hear this. So from there, I got the idea of, and you can hear that at the end of the first thing I did was, here's like, these other people are doing stuff, support, you know, Dylan over there at Loose Change or, you know,
right.
So I started podcasting shortly thereafter because I had a lot more research. There was a lot of interest in what I had to say. And so I just started saying, okay, what's the evidence available in this topic? What are the individual parts? How do they fit together? And how do I present it to an audience? Let's call that the podcast, right? Right. And then those episodes with the source material started getting long, 6, 7, 8 hours. And I looked at it more like a time capsule for the future. If I can provide the raw material and let people have a good, clear insight into their actual history, that would be more powerful for them than what we inherited, which is this very cloudy fog of war, hugely propagandized perspective.
Yeah.
So from there, I started to encounter not just Tragedy and Hope and the Anthony Sutton and the conspiracy realm, but the John Taylor Gatto aspect, the Charlotte Isabry aspect about how we were purposely dumbed down to not realize that companies can have that much power to do something and participate in grandiose narco-terrorism acts like 9/11. So I, too, listened and watched everything that Gatto, whatever was on the web I could find, I'm listening to it. And what I picked up was, man, this is grainy audio. Man, the audio is bad. The video is bad. This guy's brilliant. He deserves high production value.
Yeah.
So I chased him down for probably 6 months of requests because he was traveling the world. And finally, he called And we talked and we flew him here to Hartford and we interviewed him over a weekend for the Ultimate History Lesson. And that's available on YouTube for free, or you can try to get one on Amazon, but I've been out of stock for a while. So I just make sure it's out there for free. I put the first torrent out there. Mm-hmm. For me, it's like the people who download the torrent aren't the people who would buy it from Amazon. So let's just satiate all the groups. Yep. From learning what Gatto had to say, and then coupling that with the critical thinking and creative problem solving skills that need to be back in education, and then my entrepreneurial experience, I started to foresee the need for a comprehensive conscious curriculum. So like in 2010, I put a stake in the ground. I'm like, someone needs to create this thing. And it was episode 8 of the Peace Revolution podcast. It was called Parhesia. And now, you know, probably 4 years ago, I created that. I changed the name on it. It's called Autonomy, but it's a 12-week training course that I offer twice a year that helps to uninstill the learned helplessness and all these unuseful things that we have in our brains from schooling.
Right.
And then instill, here's basic communication, thinking, problem-solving modalities. And then here's high-value problem-solving in the form of sales, marketing, consulting, internet tech infrastructure for entrepreneurs, all the stuff that people need to get started either as an employee or as an entrepreneur. And let's just take all the mystery out of the game and see what happens if you give people a place where they can learn, interact, practice these exercises together, get actual internal experience and confidence and fortitude and intestinal fortitude, makes them stronger to approach the world, right?
Right.
And at the end, they're left being able to say, I'm always going to have problems. I'm always going to have challenges. But one of the key things I can do is I bring my attitude of gratitude, my appreciation. I meet these problems and challenges with a smile, a plan, and a resourcefulness to get her done because I've got friends and colleagues and networks. And so the classmates all have classmates and people that they've gone through this with. And that allows you to communicate, make a plan, get it on schedule, get things done consistently. So people aren't like spinning in the mud and aimless. It's like, no, I want to go over there. Let's make a plan, go over there. And now we're over there. We do this thing. Now we want to go over here. It's just getting from A to B. And if you can do that consistently in life, which we all should have been taught how to do, right? So
yeah,
it takes about 12 weeks to internalize. And then you have to like make the skills your own. So I offer lifetime enrollment. So I've got students that have gone through now 6 times and they're in the 7th season. But they've also grown immensely. So it's a cyclical learning process. It's meant to be ongoing, but there's no upsells. There's no hidden costs. It's get your foot in the door and you get lifetime enrollment. That's how I do it.
But there's also no finish line either when it comes to education.
No, I'm still doing it, man. You're still doing it. The people ahead of us are all still doing it, you know?
Yeah. You've got like a real interactive learning environment. I think that helps. I think that schools are intentionally created to suppress that, where, you know, the desks are all in a straight line and the bell rings and it's got all that factory/prison vibe to it. And of course, once you understand the history of compulsory schooling, it's no secret why it's designed that way. But we don't have to live in that world anymore. So your system, what you've done, bringing these courses online and allowing people to basically go to a different version. This is the college that we should have had the option to go to, right? That to sign up for your program and get yourself into a wide range of skills that never expire. Like I've been in sales too. I worked for some of the biggest home builders in the country in sales and always did really well. That's a skill. Whether I'm selling homes or widgets or whatever, if you can sell that and you have the ability, you can always have a job. So you're teaching, like, it's not just like geography class, it's life skills class and how to better this. And then on top of that, you've got like a network of people that are helping everybody else to sort of come along. Let's raise everybody up. This is a program that's like missing, deeply missing from our.
And the cool thing is like 7 billion people need it. And we only teach like, you know, 100 or 200 people a year. So there's always like a good amount of people seeking these skills.
Yeah.
And I mean, the same skills that I used to make a million before I was 30, I now offer to students, plus a whole lot more than those skills that I learned back then. Yeah. So it's skills that I'm not guaranteeing you're going to make that money, but that's exactly what you would need to go make that money with integrity and not have to cheat anybody out of their freedom. You need a serious communication and problem solving skill set that deals with listening, thinking, making a better plan, getting people's volitional agreement to move forward. That's it. And companies get all their money from sales. So if you don't know how to do this thing that they're not teaching anyone to do, you're leaving us to be all amidst the cringeworthy used car salesman, pushy people who are trying to persuade you into something you don't need. All we do is find out what people need and help them find it. So it's like water going downhill. You don't need to push it. You don't need to do all these other things that people have been like indoctrinated into believing. But moreover, it's not just like an online course. I have one of the new students say, and he's very well accomplished. He's like, you know, online courses don't give you what you need to move forward. But because of what we do, I teach the course live. So even though it's online, it's not canned. Everything is first time for each season, right? So I speak extemporaneously. I don't even have notes for my slides. So everybody gets it live, right? And that gives it a certain feel to it. But it's when they get together during the week between the lectures and Q&A sessions where they practice the skills. Like the first skill I teach them is how to do an interview, how to meet people, exchange useful, substantial information in a condensed period of time for the purposes of taking a next step. When a couple of weeks, when I teach them how to do a high value problem solving skill like sales, it's pretty much the same thing. It's a conversation. You have to, you know, make contact, build rapport, talk about something substantial. And then if you're looking to make a change, so, you know, it's either people are seeking a result they want and don't have, or they have a problem they have and don't want. One of those two things is going to come up during the conversation, I guarantee you, even if you're just talking with your friends casually. But now you can be a better friend. And instead of letting them just kind of complain with no solution, if they're ready for solution, help them find solution. If they're not, just listen to them and wait till they're ready to solve their problem. But like, we can be better parents and better family members and better friends and better coworkers with these types of problem solving and listening skills, right? They don't want us to have it because easily any one of you could ignite your potential, direct it toward a goal of your means and change society in a way that they can't plan or account for right now. And so that's one of the other reasons I teach it. It's exactly what they don't want you to have at this point in history.
Yeah, there's an old adage that people would use to mock teachers. They would say those that can do, those that can't teach. And that might have been the case if you go through the public school system and you see a bunch of people that have taken the job so they get summers off and things like that. But it's rare that you get into a situation, that the best situations you can get into is with somebody that has been doing it and can also teach. Somebody like you who can, it's not theoretical. Look, I make $1 million before I'm 30. That's not some concept that's, you actually have done it. You know how to do it.
And it wasn't going to happen by college diploma alone. No. Or at all. I know. But with those skills from the entrepreneurial franchise, student painters that I invested $5,000 in back then, that rapidly paid off. What did I have to do? I had to take those resources, internalize them, practice the heck out of them. But then the market rewarded me for that. That's how business works. You have to provide massive input to the market. It's like setting up a siphon, right? You have to put inward pressure, value into the market to start to get any type of reciprocation. And people instead go the other way. Market, give me money. It's instead of going and saying, what's the massive value I can offer to the market? The market will respond from that if you have something that people need. But too many people have that entitlement victim mentality, like all the things we screen out. We have an obstacle course to get into autonomy so that people with victim mentality and these sort of entitlement issues, they can't cross to that level. It's a barrier to their success. And we tell them that up front, like that's going to be blocking you. You know, if you got the I can't mentality, that apostrophe T is costing you so much opportunity in your life, you wouldn't believe it. So it's these little things that we reshape for ourselves. Instead of saying, I can't, you say, how can I? Right. And then your brain starts to find solutions. If you say, I can't, your brain's like, you're right. We can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
To think or not to think, that's the question. And by thinking, we find answers.
Yeah. Well, the link to autonomy is going to be in the show notes here. I want people to take a look. This is my pitch on whether it's my sponsors or something, a program like this. just read it. That's all I ask. I'm not saying I'm never going to give a hard sell for any of this stuff. But the reason why I bring the sponsors on the show, obviously it helps to support the show, but they're a resource. They have some good ideas. They have some great products that are out there that can help you. You also have a great product that can help people, but there's no push. There's no sales pitch. There's a link in the description. Click it, read about it. See if it's right for you. See if you're even eligible for this. But if you are, and you think this is going to be if you're interested in investing in yourself, I think, and how you quantify that, I don't know exactly, but studies have shown that investing in yourself, investing in your own education is one of the best decisions you can make. The skills that you're teaching, these are lifelong skills. This isn't just getting you ready to work at one particular job.
No, they're evergreen skills. Evergreen skills. And they'll work in the economy if it crashes. They'll work in the economy if it thrives. If we go back to sticks and stones and caveman, it's still going to help you communicate with other people, identify opportunity, make plans of action, and make those plans predictable in reality for the outcomes. That's what it adds up to us surviving and thriving. So if we put those evergreen skills, practices, methods, and strategies in place, you're going to be unassailable when you master those skills. Does it take time? Yeah. But is it rewarding almost every step of the way as you do that? Yes. So there's a potential we have inside us. If it didn't exist, they wouldn't do all these things for 15,000 hours to suppress that.
Right.
And if you start getting to know yourself and know your environment accurately, you're going to be able to take those predictable steps to get from A to B on a consistent basis. And I think that's what people are looking for. The meaning, the substance, and the progress combined with their own self-integrity and their ability to communicate their needs peacefully is what it's all about. And you can't get it too many other places. I've never seen any place with an offering like what we have. And we offer full transparency. So if you click the link, you get to know there's no surprises on the other side.
Yeah. I wouldn't have you here if there were surprises on the other side. You do outstanding work for people that are interested. Autonomy. The link is in the description. If people are interested in some of your other work, Grand Theft World. that's a great program. The way you put that together, it's like a compilation of what's going on in the world. It's a very powerful podcast that you put together. What's the best place for people to connect with you?
All right. So best place to connect with me is probably through either the two links for autonomy, getautonomy.info/whatever link you've got there, Charlie.
Okay.
But it gets you to the 19 skills document. It'll get you to the obstacle course. And that's the academic side. If you're an entrepreneur with a freedom-based business, then we have autonomyunlimited.com. That's our digital marketing and consulting agency for helping freedom community. And then grandtheftworld.com is my Sunday night podcast live stream distillation with deep dives and context of the week's news.
Yeah.
It's the best podcast most people have never heard.
Well, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's really great what you're doing. And those go for a while. You are not afraid to unpack complicated subject matter and take your sweet ass time with it.
It's a good workout. It's a good workout. I mean, some of my Peace Revolution podcasts went as long as 20 hours, but that's like everything you need to know on JFK on his 50th anniversary that no one's ever heard before. And I make a time capsule for the future. And, you know, if you think it's long now, then just don't listen to the whole thing. People have choice. That's what they don't realize.
Exactly.
That's the freedom.
That's it. That's Richard Grove, everybody. He's the best. Check out his stuff. Support his work. And if you're interested in connecting with me, you can do so through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter @macroaggressions. And if you like this episode, share it with your friends and family, because God knows the algorithm is not going to give us any help. Thanks, Richard. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, everyone listening. And thank you for tuning in, not dropping out. Peace.
We will see you all soon.